Welcome to Confessions of a CEO, powered by RG. My name is Carl Swansbury, partner and head of corporate finance, and I'm delighted today to invite onto our podcast Kevin Beals. Many of you will know Kevin, but for those of you who've not had the privilege, Kevin is a very successful entrepreneur based here in the Northeast, having founded and scaled two businesses prior to selling both to corporate acquirers. And now he's into his third founded business, which he is in the process of scaling. Kevin is not only a highly motivated, incredibly focused, very unapologetic business person, but an inspiration, given he's made many decisions that most would consider highly risky, but in pursuit of his dream, which is to build best-in-class technology businesses. I'm really looking forward to spending a bit of time with Kevin to understand what motivates him, to understand some of the learnings that he's been able to take away from having built and sold two businesses, which he's now applying to his third business. And finally, of course, just really trying to understand a little bit more about some of the things that perhaps are important when preparing a business for fundraising and some of the learnings he's encountered. For sure, I think today it's going to be fantastically additive and insightful, and I'm looking forward to spending some time with Kevin. Kevin, genuinely, thank you so much for giving up some time today to join me on my Confessions of the CEO podcast. I've known you for a long time, but we've never actually had the chance to sit down and have such a free-flowing conversation as we are going to have today. So massive thanks in advance.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here and looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, I guess let's just go right back to the beginning, because I guess our relationship really has stemmed as a consequence of your business interests. But of course, I'd love to find out a little bit more about Kevin pre-business. So in terms of education, where were you educated?
So I went into employment, first of all, for a year with that kind of, let's work hard, let's build a career, kind of realized that wasn't going to happen quite as quickly as I hoped. Went to university. I dropped out after 2 years to start my own business. I was basically doing a lot of entrepreneurial things, both as a youngster and while I was at university. And rather than do my placement year, I decided that actually I'm going to do this full time. That didn't work out. I did that for 2 or 3 years. Ultimately that didn't work out. But that kind of gave me a grounding for going into a corporate career for a short period of time before jumping back into startups and startup life later on.
You've said a lot there. I'm going to try and unpack some of it because there's a few things you've said that I didn't know. So you mentioned that initially, straight after school, you went into employment.
Yeah.
And you almost gave me the impression there, Kevin, that really you didn't want to go to university. It feels like it was something that was forced. Just talk us through sort of how you ended up landing at the door of university, therefore.
So I think, it probably comes back to a little bit of a maverick streak, which is probably a little bit less controlled when I was younger as well. I actually got suspended from my sixth form for my entrepreneurial experiences. Actually, I was selling scratch card lottery tickets to kids at the from their lunch money, which didn't go down too well with the school. I decided to go out to go into financial services of all things at that time, and joined an insurance company. And I really thought, like, I'm going to go in now, I'm going to work really hard, and I'm going to build a good career. And I did. I worked really hard. I was first in, last out, and thought things would happen for me quickly. And I just realized that, the world wasn't necessarily going to work that way. I felt then that university might be my fast track. And, whilst it was great going to university, I think that just really doubled down on a lot of my entrepreneurial experiences. And worth maybe saying, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. Like, I remember even from a young age saying, I'm going to employ some bright people. They're going to work for me and they're going to help me earn lots of money, And it was like, it all sounds very easy when you're like 10 years old.
That's right.
But, and it's a little bit more difficult, as you know, but that was always kind of part of the goal. And as you say, maybe felt forced to go into university that's how it played out.
And, where does that sort of entrepreneurial spark, that sort of desire to create wealth come from? Because it sounds like, as you say, as a toddler in a nappy, you know, you wanted to set up a business. So where did that come from?
So I think probably if you go back to some roots, like, you know, I've got a grandparent that I never actually met who was always an entrepreneur, and many of his family have been entrepreneurs beforehand. So maybe there's something genetic there. I don't know. But it was always a kind of like, I was always looking for the fast track to get somewhere quicker. And like as a youngster, when you wanted more pocket money, then, you know, the fast track was, what could I do to make money? And I always had some kind of entrepreneurial on steam, some of which were perhaps more appropriate than others, as you know, as that led to there. But there was always, you know, some scale. As I say, I was absolutely dead set. I was always dead set that I would start my own business. It then happened for me maybe a little bit later in life than I'd initially intended, but it never disappeared.
And what do you think it is? And you probably now have more hindsight, so you can probably answer this in a much more considered, educated way, Kevin. But what do you think it was then that you thought running your own business, being an entrepreneur, would give you? You know, were you looking to create wealth? You know, was this a financial motivation? Did you want to control your own work-life balance? You know, was this about you having other folk doing the heavy lifting?
Yeah.
With you perhaps not having to work 24/7, 7 days a week? Or was it something else? Well, what was it that attracted you to being an entrepreneur?
So I don't think you can totally detach it from, you know, from some monetary goals and, like, you know, and life goals that come with that. But I think that will be a little bit too simplistic in truth. I think the, you know, and you'll see this again in a lot of entrepreneurs that you meet with, that, you know, maybe there is this maverick, almost unemployable streak to them, like, and I definitely had that. I didn't like taking instructions from others, especially when I didn't agree with those. And so sometimes,
yes,
you know, that corporate, another story, maybe for another time, I got sacked for gross insubordination in my first corporate job.
Oh, God.
Again, that's like
painful.
A lot less dramatic than perhaps that sounds.
Yes.
But there was definitely something there, again, particularly maybe when I was younger, that taking instructions that I didn't necessarily agree with, I found difficult. And maybe I still find it difficult. But I think that was kind of like lent to, I want to be in charge of my own destiny. I want to be my own boss. And maybe at a really deep level, I actually had an experience of this. We might come on to this later on. That after my last exit, when people asked, what do you do? I really struggled. I don't know how to answer that question anymore, because I felt like it was just part of my identity.
Right. Wow.
And that was not in any way a boastful or arrogant thing. In fact, I used to always play down. I ran a small company. You know, I used to play down what I did. But as soon as I was at that point, you know, an executive in a corporate organization, I felt like I'd lost my identity, and I really didn't know how to ever answer the question, what do you do?
So how did you answer the question?
Really uncomfortably. And I would say something that, you know, the light, I'm an executive for a software company, and I could feel my skin crawling as I said it, because that's not me. And I genuinely felt like I lost all of my identity at that moment.
Really? And what does that tell us about Kevin?
I guess that being an entrepreneur is what I associate with, and is part of my identity.
Your DNA.
And part of, like, my, you know, my DNA, and that, yeah, I'm comfortable in that, in, you know, in that skin, and,
yes,
you know, and I feel that that is who I am and part of my destiny, maybe.
Okay, makes sense. And of course, as you say, a lot of entrepreneurs will probably be able to totally relate to that, because being a business owner is an obsession. It almost needs to be if the business is to be successful, because there's so many challenges in business, right? And so many reasons why a business won't succeed.
Yeah.
So without that sort of total commitment and obsession, you know, perhaps the likelihood of success are reduced.
Yeah.
So obviously, I know that you then had a number of different employed positions. You mentioned the financial services business, and I know that you spent some time in business development type roles. What were you learning from those corporate jobs that you probably knew at best was you treading water? given everything you've said, so what were you taking from those sort of junior employed positions?
Yeah, so I think there was definitely an evolution there, and I settled down and managed to not get sacked for gross insubordination.
Retroversion.
Yeah, it was an achievement. I was lucky enough to, I think my big corporate breakthrough was I got an opportunity to work for Adidas, and that was an amazing experience. And that led me then to come to the Northeast and work for Sunderland Football Club. And yeah, I enjoy those times. I learned a lot from those times. Probably started to feel a drive into sales during those times, even though that wasn't my job, but I felt maybe a natural leaning that way. And then I had an opportunity to work for a complete startup. I was the very first employee for a SaaS startup, one that had sold to me when I was at Sunderland Football Club.
Right.
And I took the opportunity at that point in time to join them as a startup. Then ended up moving to another startup, and then all of a sudden now I'm obviously exposed to being first in, leading a sales team, then in a growing startup. And I think then it was then just a matter of time before I decided, right, I'm ready to do this myself.
And can we just talk a little bit about the decision that you made and the full process that you went through when you were looking to leave a really secure, I'm sure incredibly, you know, appropriately remunerated role at Sunderland Football Club to be employee one in a startup? How did you sort of justify that decision in your mind? Because it must have been a pretty sort of high risk decision that maybe friends around you were encouraging you not to make.
Yes and no, but I think it leads to quite an interesting point. So maybe the thing with like Sunderland Football Club, I joined them when they were second in the Premier League, and they almost never won a game the entire time I was there, which I can't personally take responsibility for, but. And so they were going to get relegated out of the Premier League, and I knew that was going to be the end of my job there, really. So I that was facing a natural conclusion.
Right.
I had met my Geordie wife at that point. I wanted to stay in the Northeast, and maybe felt the options at that moment were a little bit more limited.
Yeah.
And so there was maybe a natural progression that wasn't so difficult. What was more difficult was taking that leap from them being in a couple of startups, those growing, being, as you say, then reasonably remunerated, and at the point where starting a family. I think the point that I decided to start my first business, we were expecting our second boy, and I announced that I'm going to start my own business. My wife cried. She begged me not to do it.
Sure.
She got her mum round. She begged me not to do it.
Wow.
But I knew it was the right thing, and we agreed that I've got 6 months to try and make a go of it. But if not, I got a proper job.
And how did you get to a position where you obviously must have genuinely been certain of success? Because, of course, you would never have put your wife and family in a difficult position intentionally. So what do you think it was that sort of gave you that inert certainty that this was going to prove to be a really valuable, good decision made?
I felt like I had a great opportunity and the timing was right. I felt like that I'd identified an opportunity and that the time to do it was right. But I think, in fairness, and again, I'm sure lots of people listening in similar organizations, similar situations can associate with this. It is quite a selfish decision. Like, if I'm honest and you say, don't want to put your family at risk. Look, probably it was a terrible decision to take. It was full of risk at a time where it was least appropriate to take that risk. But for me personally, I knew it was the right time, or I felt it was the right time. And maybe it had been building up in me for,
I'm sure it was a compounded decision.
For sure.
Probably wanted to make sort of 5 years prior, perhaps.
Exactly. And, so it felt like the right thing, but I feel like, I know it was a selfish decision because I probably for a while hid behind, I'm doing this for my family and ultimately I think especially with hindsight, I know that's probably not true. That was something that I could comfort myself with rather than it really being true. I think I was doing it for me, and you know, fortunately, it worked out for all of us. And when we, you know, got a few years down the line, my wife tried again, but for different reasons. But I think, you know, it was a selfish decision, but one that, you know, I just knew I had to do.
And it's interesting you've said that, because a lot of entrepreneurs do say that the reason they have been successful is because they are striving to give themselves and their family financial independence. And that often is perhaps how they explain away the sacrifices. The sacrifices of not seeing their partner, their children, not being at the sports day. Can you just give me an insight into what you mean by your acknowledgement that it was a very selfish decision made? Because it's very rare someone would speak so honestly, but I think there's something in that. So could you just talk to me about what you mean by that?
So the timing couldn't have been worse. You know, like the timing was, we'd just mortgaged ourselves to the hilt for a, you know, for a new house, expecting our second child. If I were to pick a time to start my own business and to take that leap, that was not it.
No.
You know, that, you know, nothing pointed to this is the time of your life that you should take that risk on behalf of your family, especially maybe a family that didn't necessarily agree that that was the right thing to do. So I think, you know, again, I definitely comforted myself at the time. But I think, you know, I can look back and recognize that it was a more selfish decision, but just one that, you know, I had to do to live my life for myself, and I hoped would work out for my family, not that was necessarily.
And how hard, Kevin, did your wife push back on that? I mean, did she say, "I'd rather you not," or did she say, "Over my dead body, will you?" I mean, how much did she contest the decision?
It probably didn't help that I said, "And I've already told them that I'm leaving." I probably, maybe it did help.
Well,
it shortened that conversation.
So that's what you actually had done. You'd resigned before you even told your wife that your intention was to do so.
I think that's probably a fair assessment. And again, story maybe a little bit more, you know, more complicated than that. But I think that's probably a fair assessment, and it just come to a moment where that felt like the right thing to, as I say, the right thing for me to do. And I felt, you know, I felt sure of it being the right thing. And I, as I say, I felt like probably I was doing it for the right reasons, even if that wasn't totally true. But yeah, and again, like maybe one interesting thing, we'll come onto this, I'm sure, as part of subsequent conversations, is one of the things that makes me help me recognize that is in my second business, and indeed now in my third, my wife tells me very forthrightly she does not want to ride the roller coaster. And she doesn't. Like, she literally knows very little about what happens at work, what's going well at work, because I think first time round she was very much riding a roller coaster that she didn't want to be on, in the front seat, that sometimes it was up and sometimes it was down. And that wasn't her. That's not what she chose. And I totally respect that. And, you know, I think I often find when you speak to entrepreneurs, there is a balance behind them, you know, and there always has to be. So, you know, some level of self-control that maybe sits behind. But yeah, I totally respect the fact that, yeah, she doesn't want to ride that roller coaster, and she genuinely doesn't. And I talk therefore about work very little. Take a very active interest in her job and her career, but just because I know and respect that she doesn't want to ride that roller coaster.
And we're going to talk a little bit about your first business of note, Test Factory. But before we go back to that, just a question. Obviously, you talked there about fact no longer do you sit at home around the breakfast bar talking to your wife about your now third business. So what is it now that you are trying to achieve in business, from the business? What is this about for you? Is it about enjoyment? Is it about creating something of material capital value so that you can point to something, you know, when in 30 years' time one is retired? What is it about?
I definitely feel like I've got unfinished business, and, you know, part of the motivation for my last exit was that it would give me time to do something again when I felt like I had that time and that energy, and maybe I wouldn't feel like that in 5-10 years time. And took, as we'll I'm sure come on to, a fairly early opportunity, earlier than anticipated, for that reason. So I feel very comfortable saying, and I appreciate I'm putting this on record now, and it might come back to haunt me, that this is the last time, right? Because I feel like there is something bigger to achieve. And yeah, I think it's actually my kids, like one of my kids does say to me every time I say that, says, like, it won't be that. Like, this is just who you are. You know, maybe they're right. I don't know. But I feel that this is the last time. And I feel like, yeah, I've got unfinished business. I don't feel like I've truly achieved what I would like and hope that I'm capable of, and enjoy it. And as I say, part of, you know, of who I am. And yeah, while I feel like I've got 10 years worth of energy in the bank, and I know that to start a business, you need to feel you've got at least 10 years worth of energy in the bank, then I would want to do that. But I've definitely got unfinished business.
And I think that when we're younger, often we're motivated and inspired to achieve for the benefit of others. So, you know, when I got my 250 meter swimming badge, the first thing I wanted to do was show my parents, because I wanted them to be proud of me. And that was almost more important to me than the fact that I could swim 250 meters. So who now is it that you want to make proud? Who is the person that you want to look at you and congratulate you for achievement? Who is that person now, if there is such a person?
Yeah, I think, you know, you obviously always look to your close family and, like, my wife, and maybe my kids. But again, I think I'm honest enough to say that I know I'm doing this for myself. And maybe again, it comes back to the fact that I don't feel that I need to do something again now in order for people to feel proud of me, or at least I hope that to be true. I feel like, you know, I'm doing this because I do feel like I'm doing this for myself. What one of the things that lights me up, as I'm sure it does for most of the company owners and founders that you speak to, is that seeing that opportunity to help others grow is probably one of the most fulfilling things as an entrepreneur, that you get the opportunity, and you're blessed to get the opportunity to do. But yeah, I think that I don't seek external, like, validation or certainly praise. In fact, I find praise quite uncomfortable. Like, some of my colleagues sometimes mention that to me, that I don't like to take the praise. I don't like to take the limelight. I like to say it's because of other people. And so, yeah, I think I'm doing it more for myself than that external
information. Thank you. We'll probably pick that back up a little later. So obviously your first business, so, you know, you'd spent many years employed, probably scratching an itch, probably learning skills, meeting people. So just talk to us about how you found this first opportunity and how that became a business, please.
Yeah, so my brother actually worked for Microsoft, and he was just telling me the story in a pub one day about that he was struggling when he was recruiting technical people, because often they would come down with their great CVs, travel down from wherever it was in the country to Reading, probably told all their family they had an interview with Microsoft, and he would know inside 2 minutes that this was going nowhere. And so he had looked, couldn't find anything, and had written some kind of online test himself. And that's, you know, very much my brother, and, like, you know, a kind of technical builder, if you like. And I was like, really, you couldn't find anything? And, like, so you build something yourself, and, yeah, you know, what did you build? And I was thinking, well, look, if Microsoft have got this problem, I'm sure others have got a similar problem. And started to explore that opportunity, and actually found that there was what felt like a broader opportunity to build an online test or online assessment platform that actually you could use to test whatever you wanted to test, whether that was technical skills of a candidate, or tests students in university who were revising for their final exams. But so that's what we built in the Task Factory, but that was the seed of where that idea came from.
And at that time, was there no online platform that facilitated, as you say, tests for any purpose? Was that not something that existed? Because that today it feels hard to believe, but of course it's difficult to cast your mind back.
Yeah, we are going back 15 years.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, to say nothing existed, it was possibly a little bit too far, but very little existed. There was lots of things for surveys and things like that, and not so much for tests and assessments at that, certainly at that point in time.
Absolutely.
So
when did you know that this was more than an interesting potential hobby that you were chatting with your brother about down at the local pub? When did you really believe this could be a proper business?
I think very quickly, really. I think, you know, I gravitated perhaps even too quickly to, well, if Microsoft has got this problem, it must be a big problem. And then almost probably did less research and insight than, again, with hindsight, I would like to help or coach someone else in my situation. I think I was eager for the validation, and, you know, and then probably had a little bit of happy years of, you know, that this felt like a good opportunity. And to some degree, it was a good opportunity. You know, it was a good opportunity, and we had a good, successful run at the Task Factory. But, you know, there was definitely some challenges along the way as well.
And from inception to when you sold the Task Factory, how long was that, Kevin?
That was 7 years.
7 years.
7 years.
And of course, we could probably spend an hour just talking about the Task Factory. But if I could ask some sort of quick questions just to really understand in a short period what that 7 year journey looked like. Was it you who founded the business in isolation, or was there a number of founders?
No, it was myself in isolation. We did start as a team of five on day one, with a little bit of, you know, support and funding from friends, family and fools, as they say. And never tell them which one they are, by the way.
That's right. This is a category of
place. Started as a team of five of us, but yeah, I was essentially a solo founder. And again, you know, maybe some lessons learned there, because I've not been in my two subsequent businesses. But yeah, it was myself on a fairly solo journey at the top.
And just on that, obviously earlier you mentioned that you are very honest when you say that what you do in business, you do for you. And I respect that clarity. Is the reason in the Test Factory on day one you were the only shareholder for selfish reasons too? Why did the other four founders not find themselves in equity?
I took a couple of people with me. I kind of created a team that I felt was the team to help to deliver that. And very much, in fairness, a founding team, and, you know, don't want to downplay the role. And the impact that they had on what we achieved, it was myself as a co-founder. You know, I didn't necessarily have managerial positions of that.
Sure.
You know, in that early stage, or I had a developer, I had a salesperson, I had people that could help me execute rather than a management team at that point in time. But, you know, that team grew into the management team. But then
became equity holders all the journey.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Yes, absolutely.
Actually, a point around creating value and opportunity for others.
Exactly.
Which I know is really important to you. And in terms of when you first, if you ever did, sit down and think, this is now what I've always wanted. This is entrepreneurialism. This is what it feels like to own a proper business. At what point in the 7 year journey do you think you sat down and felt that, if at all?
So I think I felt like, again, that was what I wanted to be doing, but it was definitely hard, and I'd be lying if I said it wasn't harder than I thought it would be. I don't think I was, like, completely naive to, you know, I've been part of a couple of startups.
Yep.
I'd seen that journey, that, you know, the challenges that happen, and I still think it was harder and perhaps lonelier than I'd, you know, when I look back, I didn't have as many mentors and support as I needed, in truth, you know, I had some, and I was fortunate to have some, but I definitely missed some mentorship and some expertise that would have helped me along that journey. Yeah, that wasn't necessarily because I thought I had the answers. It was because I didn't seek that out or feel, you know, or have the opportunity maybe to have other people around me. And particularly as a solo founder, definitely had an impact and probably an impact on what we ultimately achieved.
Okay. And was there ever a time when you seriously thought about just throwing the towel in, or did that never ever feature in your thought process during that 7 years, Kevin?
It was definitely a tough run. You know, I think the headline of there was lots of mistakes and lessons along the way, as you know, as I think any first time founder would always say. But you know, the biggest mistake is we were a SaaS business that ran a little bit more like an agency than a SaaS business.
Okay.
Part of the challenge there, you alluded to the fact that there wasn't really much competition out there. But the market often needed, as we started, you know, we're fortunate to work with some big exam providers, ironically, Microsoft, we worked with the United Nations, but often to deliver their tests that already existed online, they had to be very precise about what the platform needed to do.
Sure.
And if it didn't, then there wasn't necessarily an opportunity to put it online. You know, there wasn't a compromise of this is the best product that might be the best fit.
Okay.
It was either we take the lead to online and it works as we intend.
And not at all.
Or not at all.
Right.
And we embrace the, we'll make it work no matter what kind of approach. And it became lots of projects and almost agency work on top of the platform. And that was hard. And that was almost that really put a ceiling on how fast we could grow, because there was so much work involved in delivery. And we actually got to a point at one point where we had an order book of 12 months. You know, we needed to keep selling because we needed to keep growing. And we actually took the decision that we had to rebuild the platform with everything that we'd learned. But in order to be able to do that, we had to cut costs and we had to take a lot of costs out of sales and marketing. And we went through a really tough decision at that point in time.
And by that, you mean headcount reduction?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. And it like really felt that we were trapped, in truth, that we were either on that agency route forever or we rebuilt the platform.
And that's what you did, right?
And that's what we did. And as we got about three quarters of the way through rebuilding that platform, we got an acquisition offer that was primarily driven from here was the market-leading products being built in front of us that hasn't got now any existing clients or anything on it. And it was the biggest provider of tests in UK schools, a company called GL Education, who really saw that then as the perfect fit for how they could fast track their journey and shift all of their tests and online.
This was a completely off-market approach.
Yeah.
You weren't looking for a partner or buyer for the business at that time.
No, it was completely off-market. I went to a coffee, a meeting, and it kind of came out with got a feeling something could happen here. I could kind of see perhaps the direction of travel, and I could perhaps see why there might be this incredible fit of timing that we had this platform that, yeah, and at that time we maybe then had a couple of competitors, but those competitors were servicing hundreds of clients and wouldn't have the flexibility that we could perhaps offer an acquirer at that point in time.
Right.
So very much a technology driven acquisition.
Got it. And obviously that wasn't the plan. You know, you were 75% way through repurposing the platform and the business. Why was it that you concluded fundamentally that now would be the time to sell the business? Because I guess you were probably sitting on unfinished business with Test Factory. So what was it that made the decision?
Frankly, I think without any shadow of doubt, I was completely tired. It had been a hard 7 year journey and we still had a lot of yards in front of us. And when I saw the opportunity I can, you know, to certainly a degree change my life, my family's life at this moment in time, or I can carry on going, but you know, in a business that has already taken a lot out of me and feels like it's got a lot of yards ahead, it just felt like too much of an opportunity and too compelling to not take advantage of. And I think I was already then at that moment starting to think of, well, what next? And starting again with the lessons learned, felt like, okay, now I could do all of this again a lot easier and a lot faster. And perhaps being an acquisition that was led by technology meant that it would be easier for me to skip to the next thing.
Right. And is that what happened? So once you sold the business, how long did you have to hang around for?
I had an 18-month earnout. I lasted 6 weeks.
6 weeks. Presumably that's because, as you kindly explained earlier, you being an employee for and reporting to someone else perhaps just wouldn't work.
And I think it probably wasn't. I think, you know, I'd mellowed a little bit, you know, and we'll come on to, you know, my latter story where I really enjoyed being an employee for a couple of years. But I think I had mellowed a little bit, but it was like, I was in the way at that point and I was tired. I mean, like nothing changed after I got acquired. Nothing changed the fact that I've been doing it for 7 years and I was tired. What probably had changed was now I was itching to do the next thing. And I saw, you know, little, whilst there might be monetary value in that 18 months, I saw little fulfillment in that 18 months.
Right.
And so I think, you know, we quite quickly came to a point. I think the 18 months was probably put there by their private equity buyers who wanted the surety that I would be around.
Yes.
Rather than really there was any value for anyone in me being around.
And did you ultimately forfeit that value when you resigned after 6 weeks, or was that value still afforded to you?
We negotiated an outcome.
Okay, got it.
Which, yeah, worked for everyone. Well, yeah, there was, again, a little bit of a challenge there. There was, I had shareholders, I had obviously myself, I had an acquirer. It was, you know, pulling all of those parties together.
Right.
Point that, you know, was a fair and appropriate outcome for everyone. In some ways, that was probably harder than the negotiation for the acquisition.
I can imagine. And obviously, a long 7-year journey, which probably on reflection is like a 70-year journey, I'm sure, even though it probably came and went in a flash. When you sat down the day the share purchase agreement was signed and you gave your share certificate across the table, how did you and your wife mark the occasion? Bearing in mind 7 years earlier, she said you were insane and making a big mistake. How did you sort of reflect on the journey?
And so again, particularly in the very latter stages, and you know, you live your life in this, like there were ups and downs right till the very last moment. And I think, you know, so she still didn't believe it was going to happen, but it hasn't. And I phoned her up from the solicitors and, yeah, said that, you know, the deal's done. She nearly crashed the car. She burst into tears again. It felt like the perfect ending to the story, that, you know, it ended where it started, in tears again, but maybe, yeah, you know, it's done a little bit different.
And was that the transaction that did give you sort of financial independence, without talking specifically, did it give you the ability to no longer think about, you know, your financial means, or was it not that type of transaction?
Yeah, at that age, was it, you know, life gonna change life forever? No. Was it gonna change life in that moment? Absolutely.
Awful.
And yeah, you know, we were lucky enough, we bought her mum a house just down the road from us. Things that we would never have had the opportunity to do without that, which made a fundamental difference to family life and happiness. Yeah.
No, well, that's incredible. Congratulations. And 7 years is such a short amount of time to go from a startup to successfully selling a business. So without doubt, you know, not only deserved, but testament to effort. So obviously, you know, you're now an employee in your business that you don't own anymore, almost like a bit of an imposter is the way some entrepreneurs describe the feeling.
Yeah.
You said you lasted probably 6 weeks, if not slightly shorter than that. When you decided enough was enough, did you know what was coming next, or did you decide we're just going to breathe for a period?
I had started to think, but not totally, but I finished on Christmas Eve. I gave myself Christmas and New Year off. And then on the 2nd of January, I was there at 7 o'clock in the morning at the coffee shop, and it's like, we go again. And I started, you know, then thinking about a few ideas and playing with a few ideas. But I was like, in my mind, I was full-time employed on the 2nd of January, starting again, like having had a week off over Christmas. I was just excited to get going. I felt like really exciting, and like, I probably hadn't had enough time to fully think through and validate an idea. But, you know, now that was my full-time job.
There's something sort of coming out time and time again, which is, you're quite, and challenge me if this is not the right word to describe, but it sounds like some of your decisions are quite impulsive. Because, of course, to resign without anything to do is perhaps something that not everyone would do. They might spend the time planning and then resign on the back of knowing what's coming next. So just talk to me about that, because for me, as a very risk-averse, very considered person, that feels really unnerving. Whereas for you, you just do it. So where does this sort of instinct to be impulsive come from?
Yeah, I noticed I like squirmed in my chair there slightly. So the, but I think it is totally fair. My coach today, and like, you know, we'd come on to, you know, things that are doing later on, but my coach today was actually the COO of the company that acquired my second business, who's now left there. And he's completely different to me. And he is very, like, you know, data decisions, very, very considered, think through every possible angle before making any decision. And I miss not having someone like him around earlier on, and like perhaps now recognize that, yeah, every idea is really shiny and everything is full of excitement. And that's, you know, maybe a strength of mine, but is also a weakness of mine, that that I want to throw myself into the next thing, but can be perhaps a little impulsive and can be a little bit quick to make those judgments. And now I think I've done a better job of surrounding myself with people who will tell me, now hang on, let me just ask you a few questions before we work out if that's really a great idea or not.
But do you think, though, as an entrepreneur, certainly as an entrepreneur that likes to start up businesses, because there's different types of entrepreneur, do you think that you need to be impulsive? You also have to just take a leap of faith, bearing in mind certainty probably doesn't exist in opportunity. What's your view on that?
So I think, you know, maybe this leans itself to being impulsive, but I think what you need, particularly in a tech startup, is you need to be able to move quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're comfortable making very considered decisions very slowly and deliberately, then probably a tech startup is not the business for you. Because it is making decisions, getting shit done, iterating, learning, and therefore maybe being impulsive is more of an asset than it is a hindrance. Do I think you have to be impulsive? Probably not. Do I think you have to be fairly quick in making decisions and comfortable with making decisions without certainty, as you say? Yes.
And I guess that's more decisiveness, isn't it, than impulse, because I think I'm a very decisive person, but not impulsive, because, you know, I process everything. Like your mentor, I look at all of the potential outcomes, work out the probability attaching to each, and then very decisively make quite a quick decision to the third party. But actually, there's no speed in that at all. It is all about considering every aspect of everything. So I think there's probably a big difference between impulse and indecision.
I think so. I think so.
I understand. Okay. And so when did you know you'd landed on the right idea for business number two? Because I'm sure you've looked at lots of different options and lots of different avenues that you discounted early.
Yeah, so there probably was a few more iterations second time round. That, you know, we went down a path and then really discovered. And in fairness, I think whilst we made a lot of mistakes first time round, second time round, our biggest mistake was that, and I say us because I did have a co-founder in the second time round, was it just took us too long to find product market fit.
Right.
That path to product market fit was, you know, was quite a slow march. And yeah, with hindsight again, there maybe some sort of like lessons learned there.
And what is the key lesson learned there? Because as you say, a lot of tech startups, sadly, often do take too long to understand addressable and market fit. So why did it take too long?
I think that we weren't clear enough and honest enough that we didn't have product market fit, and we sometimes did things. You know, we'd raise an investment, we got some money, let's start scaling and let's start building out this
team. That clarity is
team. And we hadn't yet got that product market fit. And I obviously see this in other tech founders of like, it's a real challenge because, you know, you put together your best business plan to get the right investor, the right investment, and a business plan that you believe in. But that business plan is based on growing, and growing often starts with headcount, and then you add that headcount and don't necessarily, again, maybe not have the intellectual honesty to say, have we actually got product market fit? Is this truly predictable yet? Or are we just adding some bodies and hoping that helps us grow faster? And again, with the benefit of hindsight and the benefit of, you know, greater experience, that's definitely what we did a little bit too much the second time round. And, you know, it was a slow path, therefore, to product market fit. And once we had product market fit, then things actually accelerated very quickly from that point. But it took quite a long time to get there.
And not talking specifically about your second business nor the investors who invested, but just talking more generally, Kevin, do you think potential investors who are investing in tech startups, do we know to ensure that the business they are going to invest in actually has product market fit? Because of course, if not, then what they are doing is they are effectively putting money into a business where the money will be burned fast whilst market fit is established. What's your view on that? Because I think investors are partially to blame.
I think so, but I think, you know, to be fair to investors, you know, I'm telling the story here as a founder, and I didn't know I didn't have product market fit. So, you know, expecting any investor to be able to recognize that from some fairly limited information and data points can be quite difficult.
Yeah, but it does come down to the right questions asked by the right person in the right way. It doesn't
definitely not impossible.
So important, but perhaps investors are not as sort of aggressively diligent as they could be in early stage raising.
Yeah, I think, you know, so if I look back to before we had product market fit, I could legitimately sit in front of a potential investor and tell them about some of the great logos we were working with. I could tell them about, you know, why there was a great target addressable market, why this was a big opportunity, why now, why us. There was a lot of good answers to those questions. But there was still a missing piece of the predictability, both from a sales and a retention perspective. And some of those data points maybe would have been very hard for anyone to foresee. So again, not saying it's not possible. And obviously, you know, some great and sophisticated investors will be very attuned to understanding that. But I think equally, it's very easy to not appreciate that as an investor. And I say that as an angel investor myself, having lived through those experiences, it's sometimes very easy to convince everyone because you truly believe it yourself that maybe you have got this elusive, very fluffy product market fit.
Got it. And as you say, actually, sometimes it's because the founder believes that, and therefore to convince someone is easy. But of course, whether one's being honest with themselves is the point you've kindly raised.
And, you know, and sometimes that honesty only kind of comes with hindsight. It's only with hindsight that you really can look back and go, actually, we didn't.
So in terms of how long it took you to go from having product market fit to having scaled a business of note, how long did that take second time around?
So with the point that we felt we found product market fit as a leadership team, which probably happened in a hot tub, as another story for another time. But we were on an away day, and we were like, "This is it, isn't it?" This we looked back at the hot tub moment of when product market fit was really, we were really sure we had product market fit, And over the next 12 months after that, for the next 2 years, we doubled our revenue from that point. You know, so I think, you know, there was a kind of, again, looking back, that was the moment where we really knew who we would be valuable to. Yep. and how we could then create a predictable growth story and growth opportunity out of that. And yeah, we were probably at about just over $500,000 in revenue at that moment where we felt like we had product market fit.
And to the point of transaction, i.e. when that business was Silicon, where had you got revenue to? So from $500,000 to...
So we got acquired probably about 18 months after that moment.
Yep.
We got acquired in the middle of lockdown, and we had been partnering with a US company in the sales enablement space. We'd been providing a little bit of our technology under the hood as part of their solution. And there was just a timely moment, really, that we were going through our Series A round. We had some offers for our Series A round, and they offered to do our Series A investment, you know, wholly as a trade investor, even though they were quite a bootstrapped company, but bootstrapped at, you know, like 40 odd million in revenue. We kind of concluded quite quickly that actually them doing the investment was only really going to lead to one option for everybody.
Yep.
And it was really now or never. And we just felt that there was such a fit between the organizations that had already been working together for a while at that point in time. And actually, my very first meeting with this company, I walked out of the office, I phoned my co-founder, having a co-founder this time around, and I told him, this is the company that's going to acquire us. Like the very first meeting, it just felt like there was such an incredible fit of what we could do together. So it transpired. But again, that was much earlier in the journey than we ever intended. But it was a difficult decision because, as I say, we were growing fast at that time. We carried on growing fast after the acquisition. But we could see the challenges lining up on the horizon. We had in what we did, which was, you know, called sales conversation intelligence, we had competition coming over the hills in the likes of Zoom and Salesforce and HubSpot and a lot of the sales tools out there who were incorporating and talking about incorporating this technology into their platforms. And we saw that, you know, the challenge as a single point solution, even though we were growing fast then and thought we would continue to grow fast, was going to get harder, and that, you know, perhaps this was the right opportunity for us to take.
And again, was that a sort of a reaction to an approach from that business? So again, this wasn't a premeditated sale by any stretch, right?
So it wasn't premeditated, definitely not premeditated, definitely came out of the blue, definitely came a lot earlier than I anticipated. But one thing that I did that actually led to a number of conversations was maybe about, well, that time that I went to meet this company, Aleco, I actually went on a trip to the US and went to see maybe about a dozen companies that I had in my list as potential future acquirers. And I dropped all of their CEOs a note saying, I'm in town this particular week. It would be great to grab a coffee. It might be some future strategic opportunities. Feels like we should know each other. You know, we're this little old company from the UK. It was logistically a horrific trip because I had to tell them all. I didn't want to tell them I was in town for a day in case they weren't around. So I had to tell them all a week, which meant that I literally went from Chicago to San Francisco to Boston to Seattle to, like, I literally was taking red eyes all over the place, overnight flights. But we actually ended up with, you know, a couple of acquisition conversations that came out of that trip, and of which that was one. So was it premeditated? Yes, but had we done something, our goal there was to make sure that if any company was talking about coming into our space or coming into the UK, that our name would be mentioned in the boardroom. That was the goal.
And given what you said about the competitive market at that time, was this more of a defensive strategy, i.e. you were considering allowing yourself to be acquired, knowing if you weren't, perhaps that opportunity would diminish over time? Is that what this was? Because it sounds very premeditated, given you identified buyers and went to meet them.
Slightly less considered than that. I don't think we'd foreseen the future. It was more that we're building this business to be acquired one day.
Right.
Let's build a pipeline.
Relationships early.
And build those relationships.
Oh, really?
And that included going to see our competitors. You know, I recall one moment sat in one of our competitors, looking over to the sales room and seeing one of our customers on their prospect board, and, a quite uncomfortable experience. Went to see all our competitors and those in adjacent markets, just so that, as you say, there was a relationship that, you know, may or may not turn into anything.
We've not talked a lot about fundraising, Kevin, so just one question on that. How many rounds of funding did you have to take that business through from startup to the point whereby it was acquired by Allego?
I'm going to say we went through, without exactly, maybe 4 or 5 rounds, depending on exactly, you know, what we might count as some bridge rounds. We went through a regional rounds of funding, but, you know, we had taken local regional funding, so we'd never really taken a big check, if we're honest.
Mm.
We'd never taken a long amount of runway. And again, to some degree, probably lurched from one funding round to the other. And I saw your eyes, you've heard that story before. We were definitely in that. We definitely lurched a little bit from round to round.
And whilst I'm sure we could talk a lot about what you have learned from the process of fundraising, what would be the one sort of thing you would share with our viewers who might be looking to raise themselves in the coming months? Is there anything you can share with hindsight you wish you had known then that you now know?
As I say, definitely the thing looking back is that, you know, that we did lurch from round to round, and I think that we probably didn't look hard enough for fundraising. You know, there was some easier options on our doorstep, and we probably took and were flattered by the easier options on our doorstep, rather than really pushing the envelope and seeing what we could, you know, what we could achieve from doing a more formal or complete fundraising. And then also, I think, you know, I probably got, you know, a little bit caught in the trap early on of thinking that we had our funding partner, and knowing that they could continue to write checks, that was our path. And again, maybe a little bit of naivety as to some of the other options and opportunities that might have existed for us.
It's interesting, especially given what you said earlier about sort of product market fit, because of course the right investor should be helping you establish that early, rather than one having to burn time and money establishing that, because all that does is dilute you, right? As a founder, you will see, I see too often, founder owners who build a great business, who are celebrating the success of building a business, but sadly the economics mean that they don't really benefit in pounds, shilling and pence. So I think, you know, it's right and interesting that you observe that, perhaps not limping from round to round and being a bit more strategic and premeditated around raising is the thing you might do differently.
And I think you also get tied to building a little bit too much to a plan, to a business plan.
Fair.
You know, you've got investment on the back of this business plan and you're trying to execute on that. And sometimes, again, with the benefit of hindsight, making decisions or being driven by the spreadsheet rather than maybe some of the facts that seem in front of you.
So obviously sold your second business, which is brilliant, during lockdown, at a time whereby perhaps, you know, people were in the garden enjoying some weather and shielding, and you're selling a business, which is in itself quite testament to the character you are. But what resulted in you then wanting to deal with the unfinished business, and how did that take you to your third business, your now business?
Yeah, so I was committed to doing 3 years with our acquirer Allego, and you know was fully committed to that, and you know and excited by that. In truth, excited by the people that I would get the opportunity to work with. And you know I really saw a lot of aspirational people and characters who had achieved a lot more than I had, that I knew I would like learn from, and that was definitely true. And so I got 18 months into that 3 years before I even started really thinking about anything else. But then I did start thinking about something else. And then I started thinking more about that something else. And very quickly that became a kind of, now I feel like I'm on a train, it hasn't got any brakes, and like we've headed out of the station. And I felt like I need to do this, and I need to do this now. Maybe there's a little bit of impulsivity coming back here. But it was more considered, in truth, I think, at that point. Mm. But there was, I can say, I tell you, I'm not convinced. But there became a little bit like, I need to do this, and I need to do this now. And I had a very sensible conversation with Leo, and we agreed that I would, carry on for another 6 months, do a good handover, and so I did 2 years with our acquirer. Before starting for one final time.
So you're now business. Can you just tell me a little bit about what you want this business to be? Because I know where the business is, but obviously you've said this is your third and final startup. And you've said that this is you dealing with unfinished business. So when will this business be finished?
So I think, as I say, in both instances, but particularly the second instance, it was an earlier exit than we planned.
Yes.
So I think this then became an opportunity that we felt like we got a big market opportunity, something that we're very early, but feel in a position to kind of go longer, both personally and in terms of maybe the addressable market and the opportunity that sits in front of us, and some of the changes that we're seeing in technology in the world that are unlocking new opportunities for us all as well. So I think that there was more of a recognition of like this wasn't to build to get to just a point of acquisition, which was perhaps in truth a little bit more the goal the first two times round. There is more of a kind of like, actually, we could create $100 million revenue business, maybe even something more, who knows? And really felt compelled that we had that opportunity, and that's what we were going to try and do. Whereas I think in the previous businesses, it was more we could build a great business to be acquired rather than necessarily a great business to get to $100 million revenue plus, and then let's see what happens.
And you talked earlier about having a business plan that sometimes you are asked to execute on behalf of an investor, even if you feel you have to perhaps detour.
Yeah.
Do you have now, for your now business, My Sales Coach, a clear business plan that you are just executing, or actually are you currently finding your feet with that?
I think we're still like learning and iterating,
sure.
But there is definitely a path and a direction of travel. That business plan is, it's not drawn out for the next 10 years because, the numbers become all a little bit fanciful and there's, obviously far too many unknown variables. But I think certainly in terms of what we think we can achieve over the next like couple of years, I think we feel like there's a fairly clear plan. Maybe the path to do it is more variable, and I think that there is, I think there is more variability in how we do it. But I think that we've been fortunate enough that we started on day one with a plan, and we're just over 18 months in, and we are pretty bang on that plan 18 months in. So we've not been far off in certainly that direction of travel.
And knowing you, that doesn't come as a surprise, I must say. And I'm sure every viewer watching likewise will see why it is 18 months in, you are on plan. I'm conscious of our time together today, Kevin. I've just got some final questions, just because there's a few things you said that are presenting themes, so I just want to try and make sure I understand. So I think obviously it's very clear that you love starting up businesses and you love scaling businesses because you've done that twice successfully and you're doing it now for a third time. What would you say is the one thing that in each of the three businesses that you founded, were you to have your time again, you would do differently? Is there one thing each time you bumped into or you've had to grapple with and it's sort of left a bit of a scar on you?
Certainly not necessarily the same thing. First time round, as I say, I don't feel we really were building a scalable business, you know, or we had to certainly reinvent ourselves to build a scalable business. We were also probably guilty of giving away too much equity early on.
Okay. And, to investors.
Yeah. And that perhaps hampered some of our future decisions. And again, a little bit of naivety, a little bit of not having the right advice and support around us at that, you know, at that moment. Second time round is that, you know, we maybe started, that scaling before we were ready. And also, a lot of lurch from round to round. I think, you know, those are the things that I take as the lessons learned and at least try not to do.
Any notable mistakes made? So, you know, people talk about things that occur that help you learn and help you develop as a person, which is a positive. But actually, have there been any mistakes made that fundamentally were irreversible and were just clangers dropped?
I mean, littered with mistakes. I mean, like, you know, you probably could have picked almost any day in those histories except for the mistakes. I think, you know, I do think that those are the fundamental ones that held us back. I don't think we ever did anything, you know, that apart that I would call such a, you know, a fundamental mistake. But I think, you know, again, like trying to be embracing of mistakes. One of the things the founder of Allego that acquired us used to always say was that, you know, I'll get 80% of decisions right. I see it as your job as my team to tell me the 20% that aren't right. And like, you know, and I think that's very true. You know, like, we make those judgments, we make those mistakes, and we hope we surround ourselves. I've definitely done more to surround myself with the people that can help me make less mistakes.
Yes, totally respect that, Kim. My last question is, obviously you talked a lot earlier about your early years when you had this real entrepreneurial itch to scratch, but didn't really know how to scratch it.
Yep.
Hence why you sort of bounced around from university to doing really exciting jobs, but perhaps you knew they weren't your lifelong forte.
Sure.
So anyone who's watching this podcast today, who's employed, who doesn't want to be employed, who feels they've got a business in them, but just doesn't know what to do with it, what advice would you give them?
So I think the first thing that I would, would say, I think it's become slightly easier than it was a couple of decades ago to potentially start to validate something as a, you know, as a side gig. It's become easier to build some kind of, you know, MVP like model to validate an idea and to take that leap and, you know, a little bit more, you know, a surety. But it is hard because especially with like a tech business, you know, it takes some level of cash to get going, even, you know, as bootstrapped businesses, you know, where you can talk about that there is a real period of sacrifice and most of us aren't in that position to, you know, to be able to take those periods of sacrifice. I think the final thing I would say, and this is my biggest lesson learned, is to surround myself with people that can help. I didn't have enough mentors. I didn't have enough people with experience. I didn't have enough people who had, whose past was my future, who had walked in my shoes, who I could fast track my success because of the lessons that they had learned along the way. I've tried to be a little bit of that person to some startup companies myself who were like, you know, maybe a, a chapter or two behind me, and now I have those people today that's true of in my life, and I would definitely seek out those, because you can massively eliminate so many of the mistakes by having someone that has walked that path before.
Kevin, massive thanks for spending some time with me. I'm confident our viewers are going to not only thoroughly enjoy getting to know a bit more about you, but I think there's a lot of takeaways you've shared that any founder, whether it be in a tech business or otherwise, will massively benefit from. So massive, massive thanks, Kevin.
I appreciate it, and thank you for the therapy.
Pleasure. It's been a real pleasure spending some time today with Kevin Beals, founder and CEO of My Sales Coach. It's been brilliant to understand a little bit more about the things that Kevin has learned, having founded now three businesses in the tech sector and having sold two. I think the key takeaways for me are, not only is it quite clear to set up and scale a business, you have to be resilient, you have to be very unapologetically focused, and actually you do need, perhaps in part, to be selfish in pursuit of building a business that 99% of people perhaps wouldn't have the time, interest, or ability to do so. It was fascinating to hear what Kevin had to say about fundraising. In particular, he feels in each of his first two businesses, he might have raised too early. He might have raised too much investment, which has meant ultimate dilution. And therefore, when those businesses were sold, he wasn't able, along with the other operating shareholders, to benefit to the extent perhaps they should have. And also, I think he talked a little bit about limping through fundraisers. And by that, I think what he's saying is perhaps raising more capital in a structured way sooner might allow one to build a more significant business. It was also really interesting to hear a little bit about Kevin's early life as someone who evidently didn't really see value in education and really would never be a good employee. I think what I'm going to take from that is that if you have an itch to scratch, as someone who is employed but really wants to set up their own business, then now perhaps is the right time, even though everyone around you might be suggesting otherwise. It's been brilliant to have Kevin Beals on my podcast, so can I thank Kevin once again for his insights and time. This, of course, is one of our Confessions of a CEO podcast. There are many more, which you can access not only via YouTube, but you can also download the podcast from wherever you get your downloads from. For now, my name is Carl Swansbury. You've been watching Confessions of a CEO, and we look forward to seeing you on future podcasts.